Okay, good evening, everybody.
Thank you very much for joining us as we continue tonight with our fourth lecture in our series. Tonight's lecture, Matters of the Mind, What Everyone Needs to Know About Mental Illness. I'd like to begin, as I have the first three lectures that we've had so far, began with a disclaimer, and that is that I'm not a physician, I'm not a doctor. Anything that I say is certainly not as medical counsel, advice, and if you have any specific questions, you should ask your doctor. Tonight, I begin with somewhat of a different disclaimer, and that is just to remind everybody that I am a rabbi, because tonight, unlike the previous three shiurim, I'm really not going to be bringing much in the way of Torah sources. When I had sort of mapped out the series, I had a certain thought in mind for this evening, but given that the next lecture, which is scheduled, is entitled Torah Living for the OCD, Anxiety Disordered, or Struggling Addict, I think it's in that lecture, which is probably even, you know, conceptually sort of part two of what we're going to do this evening. We'll talk more specifically about how struggles with mental health issues intersect with Jewish living, with Torah living, Torah law, Torah thought and belief. Tonight, however, our focus is going to be primarily to just gain an understanding in terms of the science, as well as the social effects, dynamic in a general sense, and as it relates to the Jewish community of mental health, without really paying much attention this evening to Torah sources, Torah attitudes. In the first lecture we gave several weeks ago, we mentioned that any discussion that we have about our health, about maintaining our health and safeguarding it, obviously, is part and parcel of Torah. That itself is promoting a value and a Torah obligation. So that goes without saying. But for those who came tonight hoping to learn a few more Rambams and Shulchan Aruch, I apologize in advance, but hopefully we'll continue along that style in the weeks ahead. So tonight we're going to talk about what everybody needs to know about mental illness. And the question, which may be on your minds or maybe not, is why do we not have a lecture that says something a little different, like this: what everyone needs to know about diabetes, or what everybody needs to know about cancer, or what everybody needs to know about heart disease. Instead, tonight's lecture, and really the only one of its kind, is what everyone needs to know about mental illness. You know, it would seem to be, you know, random. Why are we focusing on this particular struggle, medical challenge that many people suffer with, and why does everyone need to know about it? After all, if someone suffers from, you'll forgive me, we'll go back, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, so then they learn what they need to do in order to adjust and to live a lifestyle in which they can manage and hopefully, you know, thrive despite their condition. When it comes to mental illness, the way we're presenting this is this something that everybody needs to know, regardless of whether or not they are personally, directly, or indirectly affected. So in order to address this question, I'd like you to consider the following. Forgive me, this may actually be out of your view, but on the top it says, picture illness in your mind. And I realize now that may be a little misleading. I'm not saying to picture what it would be like to have an illness in your mind, but in your mind, make a picture. When I say illness, what do you think? What do you think when you hear the word illness? So many of us would have the following sort of images in our mind. You see someone over here in bed, perhaps with the flu, suffering with a high-grade fever. Someone over here with a broken arm, you know, suffering an injury. Another who's, you know, has to monitor their blood sugar level in order to make sure that they are, you know, not that you know, they're not at a dangerous level in that regard. Here's a picture of an all too familiar scene of an ICU unit in a hospital. Of course, very troubling and disturbing and saddening pictures of children who suffer from illnesses. So when we hear the word illness, we tend to associate them with pictures like this of people who suffer and suffer in ways that we could see, that we could feel, that we could touch, that we can even on some level understand. However, if I would ask you to picture mental illness in your mind, you know, what does that look like? You know, what sort of illustrations, what sort of projections we have when we consider mental illness? So most of us are left with images like this in our mind. And you forgive me, I'm not going to comment on them because they speak for themselves. So these are pictures that, you know, some would say describe the anguish, the pain, the loneliness, the despair, the hopelessness that someone who is suffering from mental illness may feel. And of course, for anyone here who has not personally suffered from mental illness, so it's hard to truly relate to this, but yet we can understand and appreciate, if we go back to our subject title for this evening, what everyone needs to understand and appreciate and learn and know about mental illness, is that we have to adapt our way of thinking, our way of understanding and appreciating, relating to an illness that looks very different than, just going back to the previous slide for a minute, than this. Because this is the illness that we are familiar with. This is the one that comes to mind automatically when we hear illness. And this is something that is, of course, less familiar to each and every one of us. There are campaigns, national campaigns, international campaigns. I'm going to show you several slides or pictures of a campaign that's run out of Canada for the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. And there are catchy, you know, lines over here which are made to, I guess, sort of capture the sort of statements that people would make, probably well-meaning, but also thoughtlessly, because of a lack of sufficient information understanding what mental illness is. So here you are, just snap out of it. Is it any wonder why 2 out of 3 people living with mental illness suffer in silence? Because if you're suffering from an illness that you can't control, and you're told from somebody who's very well-meaning, snap out of it, that doesn't really help. You're just looking for attention. Is it any wonder, again, why 2 out of 3 people living with mental illness suffer in silence? Maybe you need a day off, like the 500,000 Canadians that missed work today with the mental illness. So it's these types of comments, which again may come from people who are very well-meaning, who really, really have every best interest of the individual mind, but unfortunately, clearly are missing the mark. Now, there are many myths that we have in general about life, as hopefully we've started to dispel over the past several weeks, some of them in general, about our own life and health in general. And I'm going to spend some time this evening on trying to address common myths about mental illness. The first one, in no particular order, mental illness is a politically correct term for people who are immature or exceptionally needy or just plain crazy. Right? Mental illness is really just a politically correct term. So the fact is that mental illness is a condition in the brain that can severely affect a person's ability to perform the normal day activities of life. Mental illness is literally an illness of the brain. A biological change occurs in the brain of a person which disrupts and diminishes their thinking ability, mood, behavior, and overall normal function abilities. I am not going to be sharing too many slides this evening of CAT scans, MRI scans. I'm not even sure what this means, and I'm not qualified to comment on it. But you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to have an advanced degree in radiology to see that these pictures are different. All the way on the left, you have a normal brain scan. The one to the right of that is depression brain scan. The one to the right of that is bipolar brain scan. Then a schizophrenia brain scan and OCD brain scan. But what that means, you know, I'll leave it to the experts. But what it means to the layman like me is that there's a difference. And you can't just step out of it. You can't just get over it. That there is an actual change, or as we will call it this evening, dysfunction, a disorder in the brain, which causes people to behave, to react, to stimuli, and to feel emotions differently than others. The second myth, mental illness is a sign of personal weakness or excessive sensitivity. Of course, this is a natural reaction many of us have, and I probably will say this several times this evening, but I'll say it for the first time tonight, and that is that there are people in the world who have weaknesses and are excessively sensitive and may just be moody. And no, they are not mentally ill. And I suppose one of the most important statements I'm going to make this evening is please don't walk out of here tonight thinking that anyone who you know, even yourself perhaps, who tends to be moody and cranky from time to time is mentally ill. That's certainly not the case. But at the same time, if there are people who seem to be chronically moody, don't assume that they are just being, that it's a personal weakness. And ironically, and I think that this is true, individuals who suffer mental illness often demonstrate an extraordinary measure of strength and determination in order to manage the disorder. So just think about how ironic it is that sometimes someone would look at another who is suffering from mental illness thinking that they are weak and sensitive and not appreciate the fact that this person is extraordinarily strong and determined, and that's why they're able to cope to, on some level, and manage their otherwise very difficult situation. Here's a very powerful expression, depression is a flaw in chemistry, not character. Third myth, mental illness is not very serious in comparison to other life interfering disorders. Now, we're not going to have discussions this evening about triage, which, by the way, is an important discussion not only in medicine, medical ethics, but in halakha as well. But I suppose that many of us would assume that if there's a person who's lying on the floor bleeding, and there's someone else who has some, you know, very high fever, and someone else who has, you know, an irregular heartbeat, and this person who's suffering from, you know, a very, very severe panic attack, the guy with the panic attack is just going to have to wait until I finish with everyone else. That would be our natural reaction. Mental illness, it is a fact, can have very adverse effects on the person afflicted with the illness and their loved ones. Mental illness can have extremely severe effects on a person's employment, financial management, personal care, and relationships. We're not going to really speak about this evening, but it's here and I should mention it now, and that is that the families of people who suffer from mental illness suffer along with them in the same way and in different ways. And it's a unique experience, and it's important to realize that while it may not seem from the outside that mental illness is very serious, if one is living through it or is living with someone who's living through it, in fact, is a very significant life-interfering disorder. Myth. Other than cases of suicide, mental illness is not life-threatening. We could all appreciate and understand that, God forbid, if a person is so depressed that they are driven to take their own life, that, of course, that is clearly something which is life-threatening. But short of that, so even if a person can't seem to get out of bed, and even if a person can't enjoy the pleasures of life, that's not something which is life-threatening. Another fact. In the U.S., the average lifespan of a person with severe mental illness in comparison to the general population is 25 years shorter. That has nothing to do with suicide. That's just the toll that mental illness takes on the rest of the body. People with severe mental illness are more likely to have other health risk factors such as heart disease, diabetes, cancer, stroke, and pulmonary disease. Of course, it is possible that there's something else going on over here, and it is possible that the way a mental illness manifests itself in the body has, you know, real effects, and it is linked with other, you know, harmful disorders within the body. But it's more likely that the overall toll that living with a mental illness takes upon a person's stress level, we mentioned several weeks ago how harmful stress is to the body, so this is something that has a real effect, an immortal effect upon the body. Myth. Mentally ill people are often violent and dangerous. You'll forgive the pictures. I hope they weren't offensive. They weren't meant to be. But they're serious in nature because these are the sorts of things that we hope never to see, never to touch. We hope never to be put in restraints ourselves or see anybody we love put in restraints. And the farther we are from mental illness, and the more of it is, you know, sort of, you know, a foreign concept to us, so we would associate the concept of mental illness with a straitjacket and with restraints. But the reality is that only 4% of violence is attributable to serious mental illness. From time to time, you hear people who commit terrible, horrific crimes. They plea insanity, and, you know, the plea is accepted. But typically speaking, despite the fact, unfortunately, that there's lots of violence in this country, most of that violence is not attributable to serious mental illness, rather it's to people's poor decisions. Mental illness is caused by bad parents who are neglectful or abusive. Of course, this was something that was very much accepted and assumed to be the case for many years. However, we now know that mental illness is likely caused by a combination of genetic, biological, psychological, and environmental factors. And here in this very powerful, again, ad campaign, imagine if you got blamed for having cancer or got blamed for giving your children cancer because it was in your genes. Mental illness is not caused by bad parents who are neglectful or abusive. It is true that we will speak later about one specific disorder known as post-traumatic stress disorder, which could be induced by exposure to trauma. And of course, parents can be, God forbid, the ones who would actually impose that trauma upon their children. But typically speaking, when we speak about kids who are depressed, who struggle with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or any of the other illnesses that we will touch upon this evening, so they are not caused by bad parenting who are neglectful or abusive. It should also be stated, if it's not obvious, and that is that parenting is challenging under all circumstances. You know, we don't really get a guide how to raise each and every one of our children. We do our best. Whatever instincts we have, which enable us to raise our children properly, for the most part don't apply when dealing with children or any other family member. It could be for a child trying to help a parent with mental illness. So while it is incorrect to say that bad parenting causes a mental illness, it is true, and it's a fact that needs to be dealt with, that family members and friends need to be properly trained and educated as to how to properly help people who suffer from mental illness. Myth. This is one of my favorites, because this is very common that people think this. If mentally ill people tried hard enough, they could pull themselves together and just get over it. Right? How bad could it be? You're depressed? You know, I also get depressed in life sometimes. Try, do whatever you need to do, pull yourself together, and get over it. The fact is that mental illness, like any other illness, cannot be overcome by willpower alone. And, you know, some of these facts, even though I'm writing them as facts, are my own formulations, so I'm not sure how factual it could be if I'm writing it, but I think that they're true, and there are several physicians in the room, and I've asked them individually, and I'll remind them again right away, please throw a flag at any moment when I say something, and I'm serious. If I'm saying something that's incorrect, that's out of line, that needs to be qualified or corrected, please. But it typically cannot be overcome by willpower alone. Willpower, the will to change, makes a difference, certainly in many cases with mental illness, as it does in many areas of the illness, not only mental illness. But suggesting that someone with mental illness should just get over it would be like telling someone with two broken legs to pull yourself together and stop limping, which is, you know, unconscionable that anybody would ever think such a thing, let alone say it. But that's really what it's like to say to a person who's suffering mental illness, just get over it. It's the gut reaction, it's the instinct, and it's a very well-meaning instinct of any caring, loving friend or family member who sees someone suffering from mental illness. It is what we would say, and it is what we should say to a person who is not suffering mental illness, who should just pull themselves together and get over it. It makes sense there. But over here, it may seem counterintuitive, and it may seem not to make sense, but just remember that mashal, because it's very powerful, and it's not an overstatement. It's like staying with someone with two broken legs to just pull yourself together and stop limping. Myth. One way to help someone with a mental illness is to logically demonstrate how nonsensical or inaccurate their beliefs are. Often people, not always, but often people's mental illness have certain beliefs and understandings of themselves, of the world, of their surroundings, which seem to go against how we perceive reality. And it would seem, under those circumstances, that the most appropriate, logical thing to do would be to try to talk this person out of it and saying, come on, does that make any sense? Stop and think about what you're saying. Now, truthfully, if a person is working with a skilled, trained, experienced, and licensed therapist who is employing a form of therapy which involves trying to get that person to understand and to perceive reality on, you know, on a more accurate level, well then of course that's appropriate in that setting. But if that's not who you are, and if you're not a therapist, to just go ahead, especially at a moment where a person does not seem to have a grasp on reality, and try to logically demonstrate that's not correct. For many individuals who suffer from mental illness, attempting to talk them out of the reality will actually be counterproductive and possibly harmful. One of the things that people need most when suffering from mental illness is people that they can rely on, that they can turn to, and they can feel safe with. And a mentally ill person will often feel very threatened by and not feel safe at all, and not feel aligned with the person who tries to argue with the illogic of their internal logic. Myth. People medicated for mental illness are often listless, drowsy, and subdued. And this, of course, is a very graphic and a disturbing picture of sorts of a person who's made up of all pills. I'm not discussing right now any issues having to do, we're not discussing at all tonight medication, even in a general sense, certainly not specifics, but of course there are many, many drugs that are available on the market, and it's a huge industry, which is a growing industry, and of course that's something that needs to concern us on many levels. But we naturally assume in our mind that if a person is drugged for mental illness, that's going to mean that they're listless, drowsy, and subdued. So what's the problem with such a myth? Well, the problem is, if you are being advised by your doctor on behalf of yourself or a family member or a friend confides in you that they are being advised to go ahead and to take a medication which can help with some form of mental illness, and your gut reaction is, don't stay away from there because you're just going to become completely flatlined and lethargic, The fact is that most drugs prescribed for psychiatric illness do not interfere in one's ability to function normally. There are side effects to many of them, like all drugs have, and sometimes the side effects are unpleasant. Often, we would hope always, if they're being prescribed, the side effects, however unpleasant they are, are better than the alternative. But unless someone is specifically being drugged for the purpose of, just to have them, sleep more and to have them sedated, that is not to be assumed to be an automatic side effect. Many mentally ill people must be hospitalized or institutionalized. That's a myth. The fact is, a very small percentage. The reason I didn't give you the percentage is because I couldn't find any convincing numbers. I looked in all the places and I was not able to find the percentage. In my experience, which I trust at the moment for the purpose of, let's put it this way. According to some, 1 in 5 Americans, maybe, people on earth, I don't know, 1 in 5 Americans could be diagnosed with some mental disorder. So let's assume that it's not 1 in 5, let's assume it's 1 in 10. Let's assume it's 1 in 15 and 1 in 20, but it's not really that few. But we know that there are very, very few people that are actually hospitalized or institutionalized, certainly for mental illness. So again, we have this myth, this idea in our head. I don't even know which hospital this is. Anybody recognize it? I don't know. But, that's what they all look like, right? And that's what we associate mental illness with. But the truth is that there are people, unfortunately, who temporarily, and some of them, permanently, must be hospitalized because of their illness, because it's simply unsafe for them or for others to live on the outside, but they are very much the exception rather than the norm. I do think it's important, and this is different than anything else we've done so far in the last few weeks, I do think it's important to just try to underline and identify specifically the probably the most important underlying physiological cause of mental illness. And the reason it's important to do so, not because I'm not trying to convince anyone over here, but to just say, that something is an illness of the brain and leave it at that, will leave most of us feeling dissatisfied, even if we're not the scientist in the room who needs to understand all the details and all the complexities and the mechanics. But, just say it's a disease of the brain, anybody could say that. You could say that about anyone or anything. But the truth of the matter is that even though there's so much that has yet to be discovered about mental illness, it is very clear that there is one underlying physiological cause which could be associated with every known mental illness. And that is a disorder in neurotransmission. What is neurotransmission? This is by far going to be the most technical quote of the evening. And it's not so bad. Neurotransmission is the process by which signaling molecules called neurotransmitters are released by a neuron and bind and activate the receptors of another neuron. Neurotransmission is essential for the process of communication between two neurons. So what does that mean in simple English? It means, of course, our brains, which are the centers of our body, the brain, which is the center of our whole, not just our whole neurological system, but controls everything, all of our bodily systems, requires the exchange of information, which goes through very, very quick electrical impulses, which are transmitted from one neuron to another. And they require healthy and the appropriate amount of neurotransmitters to do that. And there are many different types of neurotransmitters in the brain. We're going to go over a couple of them in a moment. Whenever there's a problem, whenever there's some dysfunction in that system, it can wreak havoc upon the entire body. Sometimes it affects our behaviors, our thoughts, our moods. Sometimes it can have, different effects as well. But it seems to, from a physiological perspective, it seems to all come down to neurotransmitters. So there are, as far as neurotransmitter systems of the brain, there are actually 5 main systems. We'll just go over them. I'm not going to test you on this afterwards, but I want you to, you'll see why I want to share this. So first there's the noradrenaline system, which regulates anxiety, arousal, hunger, reward perception. I took out some of the bodily functions that are regulated. This is not a complete list, but I highlighted the ones that I thought were most relevant for this discussion this evening. The dopamine system regulates mood, motivation, sexual arousal, cognitive control. Histamine system regulates arousal, learning, memory, sleep, phobias, addictions, extreme depression. 4, the serotonin system regulates appetite, emotion, mood, sensory perception, and sleep. And 5, acetylcholine system regulates emotion, short-term memory, long-term depression, learning, and wakefulness. Now, when you look at this list, it's quite overwhelming. And again, nobody's being tested afterwards. But basically, this is the totality of the human experience. I mean, it's all right here, folks. So even if you have 4 out of the 5 systems working, if one of these is not working at all, not working function, not functioning properly, that's enough to make your life miserable. Imagine if two of them are affected, or three. You could take a person who would seem on the outside to be completely, you'll forgive the expression, normal, but inside, everything's wrong, whether it's about mood regulation, or being able to sleep properly, being able to, you know, cope, you know, dealing with life stresses without becoming depressed, being able to remember short-term memory, long-term memory. Everything is affected by the neurotransmitter systems of the brain. And again, when they function properly, so we should stop what we're doing and think carefully next time we say the bracha of Asher Yatzar and appreciate, you know, the incredible beauty of our body when it works together and when there's a state of equilibrium. When things go off, so understand that the brain, and when things go wrong in the brain, affects the entire person. Common mental disorders. Again, a bit technical this evening, and you'll forgive me, but I think it's important. This is very helpful for me, and you know, I hope that it'll be helpful to everyone here, and even those who, you know a lot more about mental disorders than I hope that the way we'll present it will be not just clear, but you know, in an appropriate, you know, classified system. I'm going to present four different types of disorders, and it's important to get our terms correct because sometimes we hear and we use and we assume. So first, we have anxiety disorders. Several different types of anxiety disorders we're going to discuss. First is phobias, also known as fears. Phobia is a repeated irrational anxiety response to the same condition or situation. It leads to avoidance behaviors, which can be very socially damaging. So we know that people have fears, and they are irrational. By definition, when we speak about a phobia, it's irrational. If somebody has a phobia of walking in the street with their eyes closed, that's not a phobia. That's not an unhealthy anxiety. That's called, you know, helpful tools for survival. If a person is afraid of heights, assuming that they are otherwise secure and safe, so that is something that could be an irrational anxiety, and it leads people to avoid certain behaviors which can be very damaging socially. Generalized anxiety disorder is persistent but excessive low-grade anxiety which interferes with normal functioning. It's very important because there are people who are just by nature anxious. That doesn't mean they have anxiety disorder, it doesn't mean they're mentally ill, it doesn't mean that they require medication. But anxiety disorder is when it would interfere with normal functioning, when a person simply can't do the things that he or she is expected to do at his or her stage in life. So that's a sign, obviously it's not a diagnosis from here, but that's a sign that there may be a problem. In order to worry, disturb sleep, easy fatigue, irritability, muscle tension, other physiological manifestations of anxiety would indicate that there is an actual disorder. Panic attacks, which would mean a sudden intense feeling of apprehension or terror, which could cause sudden shortness of breath, chest pain, choking sensation, episodes that last 10 to 15 minutes, it should say, with great fear of reoccurrence. No emergency room doctors in the audience tonight, right? No, but, your daughter's one. You can check. Let me. I believe I once heard from an emergency room doctor that there's a very, very high percentage of people who come into the emergency room and are discharged within a short period of time for panic attacks. Now, sometimes people, when they experience chest pains and they, you know, when they think they're having a heart attack and they call 911 and go to the hospital and they find out that, so they're embarrassed to tell anyone and they feel they need to make something up because, you know, I wish I could tell somebody I had a heart attack. I don't even tell somebody I had a panic disorder because that sounds like I was faking it. Doesn't mean a person was faking it. A panic disorder or panic attack, certainly if they recur on any regular basis, is a sign that something is not right. And the shortness of breath and the chest pains were not necessarily imagined. They could have been actual, you know, responses in the body, but these are, you know, true disorders that must be dealt with. Obsessive compulsive disorder, which we're going to spend a lot of time talking about, please God, 2 weeks from tonight, as it relates to religious observance. We're all familiar with the term OCD. Many of us have heard it, have used it, and applied it, perhaps appropriately, inappropriately at times. Repeatedly haunted by annoying or objectionable thoughts, which we're going to call obsessions, or feel compelled to perform certain acts or rituals to avoid anxiety, which we call compulsions. Obsessions and compulsions are often but not always linked. So when they're linked, you have something that looks like this, a little model. It may not be very big, so I'm sorry, but it's sort of a little chart, and you can see how the cycle works. A person has an obsession, which leads to an anxiety, which forces a compulsion, which brings relief, but then more obsessions set in. And it's this never-ending cycle. So you could have people who have obsessions and compulsions and they're not necessarily linked. When an obsession is linked with a compulsion, it can become very, very debilitating and paralyzing for a person, because any attempt to resist the compulsive act may generate more severe anxiety. So this is a perfect example of a situation which many people suffer from, when very well-meaning friends, family members will say, you know, just get over it. And okay, I'm going to take your advice, I'm going to try to get over it with proper guidance, techniques, and training. And there are ways to do this, and they don't always require medication. You know, there are tremendous, there's been tremendous progress, or I would say, development in the area of psychotherapy. Many of us assume, and we're not talking about this evening, when we think about therapy, especially if you've never experienced it personally, you just think about a guy lying on a couch and being hypnotized and falling asleep and bringing back old memories. So maybe there's still a time and place for psychoanalysis, but the new trends in therapy of cognitive behavioral therapy and DBT, these therapies are much more practical in nature. They focus much less on the diagnosis and much more on the behaviors, and there are actual little techniques, and rather simple ones if you know what you're doing, which can help a person overcome OCD tendencies. But otherwise, it can be a nightmare, and particularly becomes very muddled and complicated as it relates to religious observance, which is one of the things, like I said, we're going to talk about 2 weeks from tonight. Post-traumatic stress disorder is the last of the anxiety disorders, which is recurring anxiety or other symptoms after experiencing a traumatic event or events. Symptoms may begin immediately after or many years after a traumatic experience. You may have heard about people, you may have experienced yourself having if not an actual breakdown, but having some terrible set of symptoms later in life, only to discover or to realize and to associate it with some traumatic incident that perhaps you forgot about, which happened years earlier. This is not certainly not all that uncommon, and particularly if a person experiences a truly, truly traumatic event, person is a victim of a crime, people who were unfortunately there to witness the horrors of 9/11 have been forever affected, some more than others, and not everybody has the same reaction. But these are actual disorders which, once again, can affect the brain. And it's important to point out that if a person has a post-traumatic stress disorder, that also doesn't necessarily mean it's in their head. Again, this is a growing science, and there's a lot yet to discover and learn. But one of the big trends in science today is called neuroplasticity, and the brain adapts and changes to stimuli and to experiences. And so therefore, the brain of a person who has experienced a traumatic incident may actually look different on the inside than a person who is not. Because it's not just that our emotions follow our brains follow our emotions and our experiences. Okay, the next set of disorders is called mood disorders. Two main mood disorders. First we're going to talk is about major depressive disorder, which is also known as clinical depression. This is not to be confused with coming home after a long day's work and saying, I'm depressed. Mm-hmm. Again, it could be that depressed people come home after a day's work and say they're depressed. But we use that word in many circles, and I don't think there's anything wrong with this. It's not one of those words that we have to just reserve exclusively for clinically depressed people. But understand, that's not what we're talking about over here. We've all felt depressed from time to time. This is different. This is a depressed mood or loss of interest in nearly all activities, usually accompanied by marked functional impairment. If you've ever known someone who was a close member of the family who did not attend the simcha and was within 10 miles at home in bed and couldn't get out, and nobody in the family could seem to understand it. What's this person's problem? Are you serious? You're not going to be here. Everybody's in the picture except for you. And you think to yourself, well, you know, what is this person thinking? It could be the person's not depressed, and there's some other issues over there. But the clinical depression can cause such paralysis. Maybe accompanied by feelings of guilt or worthlessness, sleep disturbance, changes in appetite that create sex drive, inability to make decisions, and suicidal thoughts. So severe clinical depression is very real, and by the way, it's treatable. Many of these are. All of them are treatable on some level. Not necessarily curable, but treatable to the point that they become manageable. But people who are depressed require often, if not always, help. And when help is available to them and relief is found, it could be truly transformative. Bipolar disorder, which is different but also a mood disorder, is mood fluctuation. When mood fluctuates dramatically between depressive and manic episodes, a manic episode will involve a person who has feelings of grandiosity, hyperactivity, decreased need for sleep, accelerated speech, flight of ideas, marked impairment in social and occupational functioning, they spend money, for example, in grossly reckless fashion, lose normal inhibitions. People can be very promiscuous at times when they're having a manic episode. And these episodes can last several days or even weeks. And they are often followed, not necessarily immediately by, but followed by depressive episodes. And they fluctuate. which of course can make it impossible, without proper training, education, tremendous patience, for people living with such an individual to know, you know, how to manage, you know, the valleys and mountains, because it fluctuates, and in each situation presents its own set of challenges, not only for the person living with it, but those who are living and trying to support them. Psychotic disorders, which are perhaps the most frightening to us when we hear them, as they should be. So schizophrenia, which is arguably the most serious of all mental disorders, characterized by delusions and hallucinations, deep feelings of emptiness and depression, and it tends to deteriorate in functioning over time. What's interesting about several mental disorders, and schizophrenia is certainly one of them, is they don't necessarily manifest themselves, and there are no visible signs until teen years and sometimes later, which again is another thing that I think confuses people who don't know much about mental illness and assume, well, you were fine until now, you know, what happened? Again, the assumption is that if you're fine until now, you're fine all along. And obviously, this is just this is something you're going through that you need to work out. But if you didn't have schizophrenia for the first 18 years of your life, there's no reason why you should have it now. But that's actually not so. Schizophrenia usually manifests itself first later in life. Delusional disorder, which is a little different. This is one who holds steadfastly to one false belief or a set of beliefs that cannot be dispelled by logical reasoning. Usually no hallucinations or impaired behaviors or functions. It's a little different. So a person with schizophrenia may have actual hallucinations where they believe, let's say, that there are animals that are chasing them in this room. A person with a delusional disorder is not necessarily hallucinating, but they could be very paranoid. They can think that the people that they work with or they live with are trying to hurt them. And not just that they're paranoid, they have actual memories in their head and can tell you that this person has done this to me, that to me, and it hasn't happened. You may have experienced this once again personally or dealt with other people, and it's quite perplexing as it's playing itself out, but this is an actual disorder, a psychotic disorder. The final category of disorders we'll discuss is personality disorders. Personality disorder deserves its own explanation before we even get to the specifics. By the way, does anybody know how many? I think there are at least 25 or 30 different types of personality disorders. It may actually be more than that. So I'm only listing a few here, but many different subcategories of personality disorders. Personality disorder is an impairment of the personality structure which leads to social and/or occupational dysfunction. Such people are inflexible, maladaptive, long-standing dysfunction of inner experience and behavior. These are people who seem to, not always, but often, can't just get along with people, being in a relationship, maintaining a healthy relationship, be very, very challenging and very difficult. Paranoid personality is pervasive distrust and suspiciousness of others. The person bears grudges, reads hidden messages and benign comments. Antisocial personalities engages in repeated behavior exhibiting exploitation, harm, disregard of others, lack empathy and remorse, rebel against authorities. Borderline personality, exhibit of pattern of instability in social relationships, self-image and identity. Often impulsive, self-destructive, and have thoughts of self-harm. Borderline personality disorder is one of the personality disorders that's most often diagnosed. And actually, that's the reason for that's almost a little bit meduyuk in the word borderline. Anybody know why it's called borderline? If you're a doctor, you can't answer this question. Why it's called borderline personality disorder? Fascinating. So I always thought borderline personality, we're not really sure if the person's mentally ill. So it's borderline, right? Isn't that what anybody else, nobody else thought that? I'm the only one? Okay, one other person thought that. So it's actually not what it means. Borderline personality disorder has that name because when the diagnosis or all these was first being fleshed out, many thought that those symptoms would be more appropriate to classify this person with psychotic disorder. So borderline personality disorder means it's somewhere between a personality disorder and a psychotic disorder. It doesn't mean it's somewhere between a personality disorder and being normal. And this is important because it's a very common diagnosis and it's real. And it's sometimes a great relief to people when they find out about themselves or their family members that they have a disorder with a name, because then at least you can begin the process of addressing it. Narcissistic personality exhibits feelings of grandiosity while at the same time needs excessive admiration from others, which seems to be somewhat paradoxical. Grandiose sense of self-importance along with an inflated sense of entitlement. These are common types of personality disorders. This is a very important topic that I want to cover, stigmatization of mental illness. We know that there's a stigma when it comes to mental illness. We know it. It's undebatable. That's true in the general population. And let's be honest, folks, if there's a stigma out there, then it's that much greater in here. That's just the way the world works. And we're not here to fix that this evening, but, you know, we must acknowledge it. So there is a stigma when it comes to mental illness. So I've thought for a while, not just for the last 6 hours since I've been preparing this, but I've been thinking for a while, you know, why is it? Why is it that there is such a stigma when it comes to mental illness? I'm sure there are many, many reasons. I actually didn't do research on this question. I researched my brain and my heart, and there may be much better answers out there. But I sort of own this question because I've thought about it a lot, and this is what I've come up with. Several reasons. And again, not necessarily in particular order, but it could be that they are. Thoughts, behaviors, judgment. See, the way the world works for most of us is that we think a certain way, and therefore we behave a certain way, and then we judge ourselves and others judge us based on the way that we behaved. And therefore, without necessarily thinking this through consciously, when we see a certain person behaving a certain way, we have already in our minds formed a certain prejudice regarding their thoughts. We just assume if you're behaving a certain way, then this must be how you think. And if you think that, well, if I like the way you're behaving, and I identify with your thoughts, so then that's something that, you know, endears me to you, and I admire that. But if your behaviors are such which reveal, indicate thoughts that I find, you know, offensive, repulsive, unfair, so then I'm going to view you negatively, and I'm going to think that you're being selfish, that you're being thoughtless, that you're being, you know, self-centered, etc. So very often, we tend to stigmatize people who are mentally ill because we just, and this goes back to comments that we made earlier, we just think that they are people who are just looking for attention in all the wrong ways because that's how we judge people. And maybe it's okay to judge people who don't have mental disorders in such a way. That's certainly the way we should judge ourselves. We should hold ourselves accountable not only for our actions but for our thoughts. But when you're looking for a person who lives a life in which there's a big disconnect between thoughts and actions, a person's behaviors are governed by forces beyond, you know, decisions that are being made the way we would make it, so then, you know, maybe that judgment should really be withheld, and, you know, those judgments are unfair. The next reason why I think there's a stigma of mental illness is because there's an absence of discernible indicators of developmental disability or physiological impairment. If you would see someone coming to shul, we have members of our shul who have special needs, developmental disorders. So a child who is autistic, let's say, noticeably so. So we would never be judgmental of such an individual, him, her, nor his parents. There wouldn't be a stigma. We may be uncomfortable with it. We may be very appreciative that we don't have such a challenge. But it's not a stigma. It's not a stigma because I understand and appreciate that this person obviously can't help it. Look, you know, the child is 13, 14, 15, 18 years old, and still wearing diapers, obviously this person has a significant developmental disability. When you have no such discernible indicators, and you have a person who walks around looking like a normal person, dressed fine, talks normally, sometimes very, very intelligent. I was going to make a slide this evening of some very, very famous people with mental disorders who are public about their disorders, but I decided that was not appropriate, so I decided not to. But you can do your own research if you want. There are many people in the world, not only in Hollywood, although especially there's no shortage of them there, but very, very successful people in the world who have mental illness, which is either managed well or not. People who are very powerful and wealthy who are depressed, which again, for some of us, sounds like, what does that mean? If you're powerful and wealthy, how can you be depressed? But again, that just goes back to the fact that we just have to change our way of thinking about depression. When we don't see these outward indicators, so that's when stigmatized form, because we say the person's normal. And it's very, very hard to accept. When I see a person whose arm is in a cast, when I see a person who has noticeable, discernible disabilities or some other physiological impairment, so it's much easier for me to understand. It's not about forgiving, but to accept. When I don't see that, so suddenly it does a number in my brain. And my brain tells me, once again, go back to number one, behaviors equals thoughts, and therefore I form my judgment. Irresponsible use and or tolerance of descriptive labels such as insane, crazy, sick in the head, etc. Now, I'd be lying to you if I said I never called people who are not mentally ill crazy, and I'll probably continue to do that from time to time. So I'm not, you know, this is life. But we have to understand that when we use terms like crazy, insane, sick in the head, you know, really crazy is not a good example. When you use the word insane about someone, you say this person's insane, and they're not. I'm not sure that's a word that you use to describe anyone. But what was that guy's name? Crazy Eddie, right? Oh, his prizes were insane, not him. Although he was probably insane also. That was, remember him. Okay, but we don't really call people insane. We shouldn't call people insane. But when we use that term to describe someone, what we are doing to ourselves and the people around us is we are creating a stigma. We're creating a stigma. That's what we're doing. Just we're saying people who we don't like the way they act, they are insane. People who do dumb things are sick in the head. And therefore, you know, it becomes much more difficult for me later to process in a responsible way that there's someone near me, dear to me, who truly is insane. But that association already creates a stigma. There's stereotyping that goes on all over from several different areas. Hollywood, if you watch movies, TV shows, some of them may be very educational, may be very appropriate. But others, particularly how they portray mentally ill people, may do a great disservice to the mentally ill community and by extension to everyone because they portray mentally ill people as being, you know, certain, you know, of a certain type. So Hannibal Lecter, for example, you know, great actor, you know, I heard it was a great movie, I never saw it, but where does that leave us? Where does that leave us when we try to, you know, deal with issues of psychosis, understand it, when we're automatically associating it, you know, with some movie? Many of us are stuck in the past. We had slides earlier, you know, showing pictures of straitjackets and old, you know, Gothic-type buildings, you know, mental institutions, and we are influenced by thoughts and experiences that we had maybe growing up when there was a lot less known about mental illness than there is today, and we have to try to make an effort to break away from that. There's a sensationalism of sadistic or serial criminals. When people commit very, very horrific acts of violence, so, you know, the press is all over that, and it's sensationalized, and it's hard to turn away. So we look at it, we see it. But what that does is it also stigmatizes the overwhelming percentage of the mentally ill community that is not walking around chopping people into pieces. You know, that's a very, 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 very small percentage. But that's what it does to us, and this all creates a stigma. Again, just to not to belabor the point, but you don't find movies like this about people who suffer with or you know, stories on the news about people who suffer with, you know, cancer or, you know, diabetes or heart disease. It's not part of the story. But when it comes to mental illness, it is. And that, again, that sheds a negative light on the entire community. And insufficient education, widespread misinformation, we're trying this evening to address that a little bit. With God's help, you know, we'll hopefully spread the word that people should become more properly educated and better informed. There was a story that was run in the Jewish Standard several months ago, actually not even, about a month ago, about a new organization that was started in our community. Actually, someone just handed me this right beforehand, called Rifa'enu, which is a healing our community from within, which is a peer-led support group for people suffering from mental illness. If anybody's interested, I didn't bring this with me tonight, but I have the information right here. So the Standard printed an article about this, and there was a reference that was made in the article about a young man in our community who died of a drug overdose less than a year ago. And his parents, who are members of our community, know them personally, his parents wrote a letter to the editor. I didn't include their name in this, even though they went public on it, I just didn't think it was necessary. And they write the following. This is an excerpt from the letter. Our son did not die of a drug overdose, as was stated in your recent article. He died of the complications of mental illness, much in the way the same person who has a malignant cancer dies of the complications of his or her illness. He died even though he had a loving and supportive relationship with his family, despite having many good friends and doing well in school, and despite having a great sense of humor and a ready smile. He was under the care of a medical professional prescribed medication to help him with his illness. Unfortunately, as with many of these illnesses, it took only a moment of overwhelming despair to plunge him into hopelessness, and he used the very medications prescribed for him to take his own life. His parents go on to write, even more unfortunate is that our son did not only have to cope with a devastating disease, he had to live with the shame imposed by the stigma associated with it. He had to endure tremendous shame over and above being ill. Had he been able to avail himself of a peer group support, perhaps he wouldn't have had to bear the unbearable. maybe knowing that there were others like him struggling to overcome the same challenges, he would have been drawn strength and been able to realize that his illness was no different from any other. We have no doubt that as his parents, we too would have benefited from the information and support offered by people in similar circumstances. We have learned an important lesson, albeit too late, to help our son. We now understand that keeping this type of illness in the darkness of secrecy serves to provide fertile ground to nurture its growth. Shining a light on it helps to limit the shame and maybe create the opportunity for a better outcome. So this is right here. This is in our home. This is not some story from, you know, from out there. This is from within here. And this really happens. It happens more than we know. And this is a very responsible call to the entire community to address the stigma. Because if you read between the lines over here, while nobody's blaming any particular individual groups of individuals, what this suggests is that the stigma itself, you know, contributes to the suicide, because there are more opportunities for help for a person who doesn't feel that they are truly alone. We're going to leave with just a couple more slides, I hope practical. Things you should never say to someone with a mental illness. If you currently know people, interact with people who are mentally ill, so some of this may be so obvious to you, it may offend you, I apologize. You may find it to be good to just, you know, review some things that you knew anyway. But should there be anybody in the room who does not interact regularly with somebody who's mentally ill, I hope that this will be very helpful. You should never say, it could be worse. By the way, I'm pretty sure I could comfortably say you should almost never say that, even if a person's not mentally ill. It's one of those things that a lot of people say, which you should never say. Unless, of course, you know, your seven-year-old is crying because, you know, there's no more green crayons in the box. You know, that would be a safe time to say it could be worse. But when people are really suffering in life, that's not something to tell them. Certainly not if somebody's suffering from mental illness, because you may be wrong. It may actually not be worse than that. It's just a season of life that we all go through. Some people do go through stages in life. Some people have dark moments in life. Some people have midlife crises. And we do go through dark seasons in life. That's true. But for a mentally ill person, it may not just be a dark season. It may not have any end in sight. It may not be quite the dark season that we had. It may actually be much more dreadful and unbearable. You need to let it go. Again, you know, one of those comments that are very well-meaning, but can be very, very devastating to a person who's trying, who wants so much to do that but can't. Go and treat yourself and take your mind off it. You know, here, I have a gift certificate to the spa. Go ahead and get yourself a massage. I'm sure that will make your depression go away. You have so much to be happy for. Can't you just focus on those things? Again, you know, we say these things all the time to people. And again, this is another example of something that is often not appropriate to say, but especially to a person who does not have the wherewithal to be able to identify happy things from not happy things, to see, to relate to it. You know, we experience happy things and we have emotions. And the reason we have emotions that make us feel good when we experience happy things is because there are neurotransmitters in our brains that are functioning. If a person does not have a functioning brain, happy things doesn't make them happy. Nothing does. And so therefore, it's not good advice. I wish I had your problems. You ever hear somebody say that? Right? I wish I had your problems. It speaks for itself. But you always seem so happy. How can you be struggling so much? Again, there are people who go in and out. People who have mental illness throughout their entire life. Sometimes it's manageable, sometimes it's not. And there are people who develop mental illness later in life. And so therefore, the fact that someone always was happy, or seemed happy, or presents happy, doesn't mean that they really are. God never gives you a test that you can't handle. First of all, I don't believe that. But it doesn't mean anything, because, you know, how you interpret the test that you're given is completely subjective. It's never helpful to tell some of that, in my opinion. I've heard great people say it, but I personally don't find it comforting, and I don't think it comforts people, at least not when they're suffering. At a moment of relative calm and peace, so then you can throw out such an idea and talk about suffering in the world. But to know that God never gives you a test that you can't handle when you can't handle the test that you've been given is not the source of comfort, it's actually the source of tremendous aggravation and pain. And you can take a person who is actually not angry at God and, you know, complicate things even more. It's because you're on medication, you should stop taking those stupid pills. Again, at this point in the evening, it should speak for itself. People do say these things, and they're well-meaning. And by the way, it could be true. people are not necessarily automatically medicated properly. Sometimes there's, the physician is just not on top of it and doesn't know what to do. It's a misdiagnosis. Person's over-medicated or under-medicated. It could be, but it is not appropriate for a layman to say to someone else, it's the drugs that are making you that way. If you have such a concern, you know, there are ways to deal with that. And, of course, you should be able to relay that concern in a safe, appropriate way. Things you should say to someone with mental illness. We'll go through this much quicker. You're not alone. I have no idea what you're going through, but I am here for you. You should never say to somebody, I know what you're going through. By the way, it's just another, giving you all my rabbi tips tonight. You should never say to somebody, you know, what they're going through. Even if you suffer from depression and you're trying to console somebody who's going through it right now, you should never say, I know what you're going through. The experience is so unique, you can't know what you're going through, what this person is going through, and you can't know that it's the same thing. If you have a relationship with someone, and you experience the exact same thing, you may be able to, you know, allude to the fact that you have some idea, perhaps, you know, maybe what this person perhaps sometimes is feeling. But to say, I know what you're going through is not appropriate. And specifically to say, I have no idea what you're going through is very validating and actually very comforting to a person who's going through something painful. You are not going crazy to reassure a person who feels like they are that they're not. You are stronger than you think. There is hope. You will get through this. These are the types of things, once again, that people find very helpful. We will not abandon you. This is the last slide of the evening. I'm not really talking about suicide, risk intervention, risk assessment, things like that. Obviously, this is a very, very serious discussion. Everything we discussed tonight is serious. This is even more serious. But I think there are a couple of good things that everybody should know. It's like learning CPR. You know, we all hope never to use it, but if you're, you know, there when a person falls to the floor and nobody else is around, you definitely want to know it. From time to time, you may interact with people who you suspect may be having suicidal thoughts. There are intuitions that many of us have, which are actually not the way to go when it comes to dealing with someone who is having suicidal thoughts. So, for example, most of us would think the last thing you want to say to a person who looks like they may be considering suicide is, are you considering harming yourself? Because our gut tells us that you're just putting a very, very dangerous thought into the person's head when, they seem to be on the brink. But actually, for many reasons, some of which I understand and none of which we have time to talk about right now, actually, that is considered to be an appropriate question. Not necessarily the first question. When you see somebody who's looking like they're a little sad one day, you're thinking of harming yourself. But if there's a person who is, you know, exhibiting some very, very concerning signs, it actually is an appropriate question to ask. And it's one of the first questions that, professionals will ask. All this comes, by the way, from the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Be direct, talk openly and matter-of-factly about suicide. I think they suggest saying, not, are you considering suicide, are you considering harming yourself? That's a safer way to ask the same question. Be willing to listen, allow expressions of feelings, accept the feelings. Be non-judgmental, don't debate whether suicide is right or wrong, or whether feelings are good or bad. Don't lecture on the value of life, you'll be so missed. These are not the things to say to a person who is considering suicide. Get involved, become available, show interest and support. Don't dare him or her to do it. Don't act shocked, this will put distance between you. Don't be sworn to secrecy, seek support. Offer hope that alternatives are available, but do not offer glib reassurance. Take action. Remove means such as guns or stockpiled pills and things like that. Get help from persons or agencies specialized in crisis intervention and suicide prevention. Again, if you're interested in this, as we all should be, and you just want to just have it in the back of your mind, you can get it straight from the Suicide Prevention Lifeline.org. But this is important because even people who are not necessarily trained, people who are not in the business of helping others who suffer from mental illness may from time to time, again, hopefully very rarely or never, find themselves in this situation. And if you ever do, you really want to know what to do, what to say, and how to be supportive for that person, and this is a good way to go. Many of us, if we would just leave it to our instincts, would probably, again, be very well-meaning, but that notwithstanding, say the wrong things. I appreciate your coming out. I appreciate your listening and your, you know, opening yourselves up to this. It's very important. It's very important to talk about. It's very important to think about. And it's very important that we work together as a community to figure out how to, you know, get more people to think about mental illness, to accept that it's a reality for many, many people. Thankfully, as I mentioned before, and we're going to speak about this tonight, but there are so many different venues for treatment that are available today. people who have mental illness are able to live sometimes very, very normal lifestyles when they're able to manage the mental illness. But we have the, you know, greatest responsibility to try to chip away at that stigma. I don't know how realistic it is to think that we can, you know, change the entire world overnight. But, you know, we can certainly within our own lives, within the lives of our families, we can work together to chip away at that and make people who suffer directly, personally, or indirectly from mental illness to feel more validated, to feel more understood, welcomed, and supported in our community. Next week, there will be no shiur because it's Hanukkah and many people have other obligations. But 2 weeks from tonight, we will talk about Torah living for the OCD, anxiety disordered, or struggling addict. Thank you again. Everybody have a Freilich and Hanukkah. Enjoy, and I hope to see you then.